You're listening to episode 337 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof, boiling in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Boy, it's hot, Max.
It is. It is, David. But hey, we're used to this, right? We're supposed to be used to this.
Yeah, I know. But the things we have to sacrifice, like air conditioning, in order to provide quality to our listeners is kind of, I don't think they understand what we suffer to do for our art.
Yeah, everything is shut down. No fans, no AC, nothing.
But we got a lot of good news. We've got a military drone over San Diego, hacking drones as a target and as a weapon, drone report card, where does your state fit in? Milestones in India for civilian drones. Ehang 216 goes sightseeing. And more about those drones in the Midwest. This was a pretty comprehensive story from The Drive. So more about our favorite UF drones. Unidentified flying drones. UFDs. So should we get started?
David, let's get started.
Well, our first story comes from Forbes.com. Secret General Atomics drone flights over San Diego raise surveillance concerns. Looks like they flew a Sky Guardian or a Predator drone over the San Diego area, and a lot of people are concerned that their privacy is being violated.
Because nobody knows what the mission is, I guess. At least a lot of the articles indicate that it's not clear what the mission of this drone is doing, but we know some things about the Sky Guardian, David. We know it has some advanced systems which are pretty handy for flying in the civilian airspace. The one I like the best, though, of these three systems is the Due Regard Radar, DUE. That must stand for something, but I think that's a pretty funny name.
And that can detect other aircraft and within the same view field of view as a pilot, which is kind of interesting that you've got the same forward visibility that you would have normally. It also has an advanced TCAS, which is traffic alert and collision avoidance system, which I think is really why they were flying it. They were flying it in the airspace to work on flying in the NAS, which is something we've always sort of strived for. Keep in mind, the Sky Guardian actually is the overseas variant or the civilian variant of a Predator, but it's primarily right now in use in Great Britain.
And it's also flying with ADS-B, which, of course, is Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast. That's a system that continuously broadcasts the location of the aircraft. So with those three things, the Due Regard, the TCAS, the ADS-B, this thing seems to be pretty well equipped. But, you know, David, these stories first came out about 2 weeks ago, and they haven't seen or found anything since then. So I don't know if this thing's been flying or what.
Well, in all fairness, if you're going to test fly in an airspace, most people think of, you know, Edwards and the Mojave for test flying. But a lot of, if you're going to fly in a civilian airspace, the Los Angeles area is probably too dense to do an experiment like this. So San Diego might be just an alternate solution because, yeah, it has a higher volume than just out in the open, but it doesn't have the volume as, say, the Los Angeles area or San Francisco. Even in this day and age of the viruses, that's still pretty crowded airspace. Hmm. So our next story comes from JD Supra. Drones aren't just hackers' targets. They're hackers' weapons. Well, this is kind of timely. And, you know, last night we experienced the great failure of Twitter, you know, getting hacked. But hacking is something that's become commonplace in our universe.
Yeah, it sure has. And this is centered around a report by the RAND Corporation. They produced a 96-page report. It's titled, How to Analyze the Cyber Threat from Drones. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes. And so you can take a look at that. But J.D. Supra lists some takeaways that they had after reviewing the report. And one of the interesting things is that in this report, there are summaries of 26 specific instances where drones were exploited. And these are both examples of when drones were taken over by hacking and when drones were used as weapons resulting from a hacking attempt.
Like the bad 24 episode in the days where they hacked into the drone over Los Angeles. The first one, though, Max, I have to give to you on this topic because it's not quite fuel cells, but it is one of your favorite things.
Raspberry Pi. One of the examples was a Raspberry Pi that was used to take over a drone. And, of course, if you know anything about the Raspberry Pi, it's a very small but surprisingly powerful little computer on a board that usually costs about $35. So the point here is, with an inexpensive device, the Raspberry Pi, and some clever programming, someone was able to take over control of a drone. And one thing they noted in the article, too, is, and this is almost maybe more alarming, is that they've seen that the code, the hacking code for some of these exploits like this one, have turned up published in, hacker sites, I'll call them. Point being, available widely for those that might be interested. So that's kind of scary, David.
Open source code for hackers.
Yeah.
Rand also used the STRIDE classification system, and I like this in the article. STRIDE stands for spoofing, tampering, repudiation, information, disclosure, denial of service, and elevation of privilege. There's a lot of bad there, all in one word, for just one word.
So those are the categories, and they said that the most common types of cyber attacks that they reviewed were in the denial of service or spoofing categories, and in these cases, against an active drone. So they had some examples. One was a drone flying over an area, surveying Wi-Fi networks, looking to identify vulnerable networks, those that could be hacked into easily. I think maybe a lot of that is people that aren't password protecting Wi-Fi networks or things of that sort. And so in this case, that opened the door for those networks to be targeted, added to botnets, which could then spew spam or launch attacks against other computers and so forth. So that one is pretty scary.
This is definitely not a drones for good article, but it is interesting the way you can weaponize a drone beyond what we used to talk about weaponizing a drone. This is fairly clandestine sites, and to fly a small quadcopter over like an apartment complex like I live in, I guarantee you they will find at least two or three houses that aren't password protected. It's just people just don't realize the vulnerability of their system. So that is kind of frightening. Though I will say that the other part of this is some of these hacks were done in a research environment. So they weren't done out in the field, but still it does open up a lot of opportunities or something to think about, especially when we get more and more drones active in the airspace. Like the article said, we've talked about drones being hacked or counter UAS, but in this case, the UAS is also doing evil things that pretty much would be inconspicuous.
Another example that I really kind of like because it makes a couple of points is an example of a drone flying near a building and then injecting malicious code that modified the software of smart light bulbs. So this is, you know, IoT, you know, Internet of Things. You know what I always say about that topic, David, is that the S in IoT stands for security.
Yeah, I know. It's
there is none.
There is none. It, you know, it was funny. My friends, my good friends, they had a washer that dishwasher that died, and they went out looking for a new dishwasher. One of the things was one of the dishwashers had a Wi-Fi setting. Mm. And I jokingly said to my friend's wife that, you know, that's when Peter forgets to turn on the dishwasher, you can turn it on remotely. But that's a network point where it can get into your house, you know, and that's if you've got thermometers or whatever, you know, it gets kind of scary.
So the RAND Corporation had some recommendations in their report. They're all, well, three of them, and they're directed to the DHS, Department of Homeland Security. They say the DHS must continue to work with senior policymakers, cybersecurity experts, and other government and law enforcement agencies to move towards a coherent UAS cyber strategy. I like that. Also, the second one, DHS should also prioritize the most critical vulnerabilities and find ways to close attack vectors and protect attack surfaces. And then the final RAND Corporation recommendation was that DHS needs to monitor UAS adoption and anticipate the implications of widespread UAS diffusion. So, yeah, let's look ahead and think about what the implications are of what might happen. But
well, I read those two things, and all I can think about is if you think about these words, they apply perfectly to the current pandemic. The Department of Homeland Security should also prioritize the most critical vulnerabilities and find ways to close attack vectors and protect attack surfaces. And the second one, the department needs to monitor virus adaptation and anticipate the implications of such widespread virus diffusion. It's an interesting parallel between the two things. So that's my topic about the virus this week. But it was just sort of interesting that they have parallel implications for both.
Yeah, kind of ironic.
So the next article talks about, is your state prepared about viruses? Which states are prepared for the drone industry? And this was from Mercalis.com, a 50-state report card. The report card ranks states on their readiness to get new drone technology into America's skies. As usual, I'm deeply disappointed in the state in which I reside.
Yeah, I know. I was sure to check on Pennsylvania for this, but I also checked on Connecticut. So in any case, the authors of this, they argue that states should take the lead. Individual states should take the lead in terms of exploiting, exploring, developing capabilities of unmanned aircraft and how they can benefit the economy and employment and all of that. And they say that they should take this lead by creating drone highways that mirror the paths of the public roads beneath them. So that's kind of interesting. But this report card, it makes a number of points. One is that many states already possess the legal rights to demarcate drone highways and establish rules for their use. I don't know. Is this a sort of federal state kind of thing going on here, David? I'm not sure about. But also state and local authorities should manage the new drone highways, and authorities can monetize this currently unused public resource. That's the public right-of-way between 50 feet and 200 feet above the ground.
It's interesting that they're implying states should make their turnpikes with EasyPass for drones.
Basically, it's
a very interesting spin. I don't think the FAA is going to go along with it, but it's definitely, you know, it's interesting that, you know, in Pennsylvania is one of the states with the most airports in the United States, you know, and we were the first people to have a turnpike. So it's really disappointing that my state is so far down the list on this. But, you know, states with these kind of laws have airspace lease laws. Drone highways must be demarcated by regulators and safely inspected, safely separated from airports, homes, schools, and other sensitive locations. That's a lot of work. You know, I mean, that's a lot there to avoid, especially if you're in an urban environment like we are in the Northeast Corridor.
Another criteria that they used in ranking the 50 states was that states that had laws vesting air rights with landowners played a part in the ranking. And these are laws that clarify that the state is exercising its police powers and defining property rights. That's interesting. They also inform drone operators and residents about the extent of homeowners' property rights, which reduces litigation risk for operators and homeowners alike. So, I mean, I see what they're trying to do here, but again, who, you know, do the states have the power?
Do you own the airspace above your house? I don't know that answer.
I think it's no.
It's no. But
so there's a third criteria they use,
and that's navigation easement law. So we're going back to nautical history here, folks. These laws allow drone operators to fly so as long as they are high enough not to bother landowners or passerbys. Again, this is all good, well and good if the FAA says go for it, but that ain't going to happen.
So, and there were a couple of other factors that were considered in establishing this report card, whether there was an aviation advisory committee in the state, and also the number of drone jobs estimated in the state also factored in. But let's get right to the results, David. We're not going to go through all 50, certainly, but maybe the top five.
Okay, well, I guess I'll go backwards. Number five was Nevada. Number four was Oklahoma. Number three was Vermont. Number two was Arkansas. And number one was North Dakota. Now, with Nevada and North Dakota, I get it because they're both test sites and they've had active things. But Arkansas, I just, that one sort of blew my mind. It's like, okay, if you want to go fly your drone, Arkansas it is. Little Rock, here we come.
Yeah, number two. So we had to look and see who was last in the list, the worst. Number 50 of all the 50 states, which is gets the lowest report card standing.
This was sort of surprising, too. South Carolina. You would think that given the aviation industry that's brokering there and growing there, or at this point right now, shrinking there, but you'd think they'd be more drone savvy. And then, of course, we've got our two beloved states. Pennsylvania was tied with West Virginia for 37th. And Connecticut, number 23, was tied with
Missouri. So we're pretty far down the list, David.
Well, yeah, but Max,
at least I'm in the top half.
Right. And we know when it comes to weaponizing quadcopters, your state's at the top of the list.
I wonder if we got extra points for that.
Marked off? Yeah, probably.
Probably. So, of course, link in the show notes. This all comes from the Mercatus Center, which is, well, they do policy research, and they're associated with George Mason University, which has, I think, most of its locations in Northern Virginia, right outside D.C.
So let's go to the other side of the world and talk about India's first NPNT, compliant drone flight successfully completed. India's first no permission, no takeoff compliant drone flight was successfully completed. Now, to go back in the days, India implemented if you don't have permission, you don't fly. And that went across the board for all scales. And evidently, now they've got a way to grant permission so you can go flying.
They do. They changed the policy in 2018. And this is the first test under the new requirements. But they are pretty stringent. And you can see why it took from 2018 to 2020 to actually test this. But there are a number of requirements. UAVs have to comply with pretty stringent manufacturing standards. UAVs also have to be compliant with this new NPNT, no permission, no takeoff, architecture. And under the architecture, each drone has a unique identification number, a UIN. You also have to have an unmanned aircraft operator permit. Every flight needs permission, and that's obtained online. And the whole workflow for all of this is managed through an online portal called Digital Sky. And so that sort of whole process is what was demonstrated, apparently successfully, in this case.
The test was completed with an A200 remotely piloted aircraft system with the unique identification number of U60-601. Needless to say, they've got a lot of code there written, so they're going to have a lot of drone operators. And Max is guessing, did a little research on it, and it was an ASCO A200, which is a $50 U.S. quadcopter.
I don't know if it's a U.S. quadcopter.
$50 U.S. quadcopter.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Got it.
Comma.
Got it, got it.
But I'm bumps.
Sorry. Let's move on to EHang.
Okay, let's move on. This is kind of our video of the week, but an EHang 216 autonomous aerial vehicle is conducting sightseeing flights in Yantai, a coastal city of East China. Now, we've talked about air taxis doing sightseeing, but now that's actually implemented.
There were four passengers that flew around a wharf area, fisherman's wharf area, that's, I think, popular with tourists. Now, of course, the EHang 216 is a two-passenger aircraft, and in the video, at least as far as I could tell, each example showed just one occupant in the EHang 216. So I guess there were four flights anyway, if there were four people that that did this. And I did notice, David, that the ground was damp, and you could see from the aerial photos that people had umbrellas up. So I don't know how severe the rain was, but that was just kind of remarkable that they conducted the test in the rain.
Well, it is kind of that time of the year in Asia. It's going to rain a lot. So, but yeah, I also was sort of surprised at that there was, you would do a first attempt with people in foul weather. EHang's founder and CEO said, quote, "As the world's first provider of passenger-grade AAVs, we are honored to prove this game-changing air mobility solution by demonstrating flights to regulations, customers, and partners, and the general public. The positive support and feedback have given us strengthened our determination in our quest to bring this new style of mobility to the people." So the urban air mobility, I guess that's going to be the future. It's coming whether we want it or not.
And EHang seems to be rocking and rolling. I mean, you know, we've seen the hotel that was going to have, passengers, transportation provided by EHang and so forth in this demonstration. They say this is part of a world flight tour. So I'm curious to find out what the schedule is, where EHang is maybe going to go around the world demonstrating this capability.
I want to volunteer. I want to volunteer. I want to volunteer.
I hope you fit inside. It's a small cabin. It's a very, very small cabin from the looks of it. So I don't know if your 6'4" frame would be comfortable. And maybe you could sit sideways in it or something, David.
Out on the stretcher, out on the skids, a la MASH, right?
Right, right. So we'll have the video in the show notes. I was really disappointed, though, that they have the comments turned off for the video, which I guess I can maybe understand why, except that I always find it quite illuminating to see what kinds of people provide what kinds of
feedback. Comment.
Yeah, feedback. So, but anyway, so, but the, it's a short video and worth taking a look at.
Well, that was a short video. I have to admit, this is a very long article, folks, but it's incredibly interesting. And this is from our friends over at thedrive.com. Newly released FAA documents give unprecedented look into Colorado drone swarm mystery. So back in late last year, in 2019, in January 2020, the skies over Colorado were filled with drones, and everybody and their brother was reporting it.
Yeah, Colorado, Nebraska, and Kansas. And a lot of the reports came from law enforcement, from you know, people who you would consider to be credible witnesses. And, of course, this got a lot of press. We talked about it several times. We never really got a good answer as to what this was all about or who was behind it or any details. So a particular individual has filed some Freedom of Information Act requests. This is a volunteer researcher for the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. And they obtained a lot of documents, and they're pretty interesting.
And UAP stands for Unmanned Aerial Phenomena, otherwise known as UFOs.
Right.
Hundreds of pages of emails and other documents were obtained from the FAA and other federal agencies. There's a volume of stuff. This was going, I know we talked about it in the past that it seemed to be going around a lot with people trying to get their hands on what was going on, but this proves that there was a lot of people touching this subject matter.
Sort of a summary of what these documents say to us is that, for one thing, the FAA doesn't know who was behind the sightings. Right? The FAA had the lead in this investigation. But, and this is a quote, there is high confidence these are not covert military activities. I'm not sure what that leaves us with, David, but imagine.
And to support what that leaves us with is, interesting enough, was, and this is really important, was witnesses were credible and the reports were consistent. People were reporting seeing the same thing. And like you said previously, I mean, it was people who are designed to be observers, like law enforcement, pilots, people who are credible witnesses, and they all saw the same thing, and their descriptions match what everybody else saw, which is kind of interesting. The drones never encroached on a military installation, and no federal laws were broken.
Criminal laws.
Yeah. So we have lots and lots of documents with lots of people looking at it, but you know what? We're still in the dark about what was flying at night.
And there were others involved in this besides the FAA, involved in the investigation, that is. There were other government entities, the FBI, the DHS, and the military. But it sounds like their role in the investigation was much, much less than that provided by the FAA. But the researcher did conclude that the FAA really did take this seriously. They used the resources available to them. They had, you know, good investigators involved in this. But when the sightings ended, which they did kind of abruptly, if I recall correctly, so too did the investigation end, apparently.
Nothing to see here, folks. It was swamp gas. I don't know. I mean, that is kind of an interesting conclusion that, okay, they've stopped. Let's stop and not go any further. This is really a fascinating mystery because it's definitely something happened. What it was, we don't know. But clearly there was something going on at the time, and we may never know, or we may find out a little later. But what I suggest you do is definitely read the article over on The Drive, because it is well-researched and very in-depth. And a lot of fascinating aspects to it that we haven't touched here because we just don't have time, but it's definitely worth reading.
Yeah, there's more examples, quotes from the documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act. There are links to some other documents. There really is a lot there. But one other thing is that despite the fact that they've received hundreds of pages of emails and documents from the FAA, there are hundreds more additional documents associated with this that are still being processed by the FAA under the FOA request here. And interestingly, the FAA is withholding some documents, claiming or stating, I don't want to say claiming, it sounds, but stating that they are exempt from FOA. Now, I don't know what it takes to be exempt, David. It sounds like, you know, like national security or I don't know what, but apparently there's a category or a classification that allows the government to not release documents. And it seems like there are at least some of them that fall into that category.
And I'm not surprised because in the last time we discussed this, part of it was the U.S. military's actions. And they did talk about implementation of counter UAS at the time. So that kind of information might still be classified and the FAA might not want to report it. But I guess, Max, we're going to roll the music from Close Encounters and call this a to be continued.
Yeah, and when we're done here, I'm going to go watch some more episodes of Ancient Aliens or the other new series that's starting season two. What's that called? Unexplained or something?
The Unexplained, yeah, with Mr. Bill.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. One more item. This is from a press release. Kespri appoints Krishnan Hariharan as vice president of engineering, overseeing Kespri's aerial intelligence platform development. Hariharan was vice president of engineering and product management for Precision Hawk. So he's moving from Precision Hawk to Kespri. And before Precision Hawk, he had a number of different leadership roles in a variety of different companies, many of them related to software as a service types of operations. We've talked about companies merging, consolidating. Of course, that can happen at the company level, but in this industry, I think another trend we're going to see is individuals moving around from one company to the next, still in the drone segment, but sharing or redeploying maybe some of the expertise. I think this could get kind of interesting as we go forward.
So, Max, I've got one question for our listeners.
Okay.
You and I have struggled with the term unmanned.
Oh, I know what you're going to say. Yeah, good, good.
Remotely piloted, and this goes back to episode one for us where we weren't supposed to use the word drones. Both Max and I have gotten, I don't want to say uncomfortable, but we would like to figure out what a better terminology is to be more inclusive.
Yeah, something that's gender neutral.
Something that's gender neutral. Now, unmanned is as pervasive as drones in this industry. But I'd like to hear from our listeners. Send us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com and let's have a discussion. We want to just get a feel because, like I said, Max and I have been hesitant to use that terminology for a while now, and we'd like to be more inclusive. And I'd like to hear what everyone else thinks in our industry because I really do believe that our industry is inclusive, and we seem to be, while we've got a lot long steps ahead of us, but I think as an industry itself, we seem to be ahead of the curve on being inclusive. So give us a shout out. I'd like to start a dialogue about that. Is it okay to use unmanned? Is it, or should we be trying to find something else to move forward with. So that's my question for all of our folks.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. Meantime, we'll thank you for listening to the UAV Digest. You can find us at the UAVDigest.com in show notes, including links to the video we talked about and the some of the reports that we mentioned. You can find all that at the UAVDigest.com/337.
And of course, you can find us on Twitter at UAVDigest.com, on Facebook at Facebook.com/UAVDigest. And we'd love for you to become part of our Slack listener team, and you can do that by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. If you're listening to this on Friday, we'd like to extend an invitation to the Airplane Geeks Not at Oshkosh party, which will occur on Tuesday the 21st at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And you can just send us an email. We'd love for you to join the conversation. We've done this once before and had a lot of laughs at a good time, and it was good sharing, being with everybody in a social environment. You know, open up a beer or a glass of wine or a cocktail of choice or a soft drink. But we'd love to invite you to that. And again, you can get that invitation by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com or feedback@theuavdigest.com. So with that, I'm going to say I need to put the AC on. This is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.